Lyra looked up at John Farr's massive frame. Her heart was thumping so much she could hardly hear the first words of his reply.
Now spell it out, Raymond. Don't be shy. You want us to give this child up to them she's a-fleeing from. Is that right?
The man stood obstinately frowning, but said nothing.
Well, perhaps you would, and perhaps you wouldn't. But if any man or woman needs a reason for doing good, ponder on this. That little girl is the daughter of Lord Asriel, no less. For them as has forgotten, it were Lord Asriel who interceded with the Turk for the life of Sam Brookman. It were Lord Asriel who allowed Egyptian boats free passage on the canal through his property. It were Lord Asriel who defeated the Watercourse Bill in Parliament, to our great and lasting benefit. And it were Lord Asriel who fought day and night in the floods of 53, and plunged headlong in the water twice to pull out young Rood and Nellie Koopman. You've forgotten that? Shame. Shame on you, shame! Now that same Lord Asriel is held in the farthest, coldest, darkest regions of the world, captive in the fortress of Svalbard. Do I need to tell you the kind of creatures are guarding him there? And this is his little daughter in our care, and Raymond Van Herid would hand her over to the authorities for a bit of peace and quiet. Is that right, Raymond? Stand up and answer, man.
But Raymond Van Herit had sunk to his seat, and nothing would make him stand. A low hiss of disapproval sounded through the great hall, and Lyra felt the shame he must be feeling, as well as a deep glow of pride in her brave father. John Farr turned away and looked at the other men on the platform.
Nicholas Rokeby, I'm putting you in charge of finding a vessel and commanding her once we sail. Adam Stefanski, I want you to take charge of the arms and munitions and command the fighting. Roger Van Poppel, you look to all the other stores from food to cold weather clothing. Simon Hartman, you be treasurer and account to us all for a proper apportionment of our gold. Benjamin De Ruyter, I want you to take charge of spying. There's a great deal we ought to find out, and I'm giving you the charge of that, and you'll report to Father Corum. Michael Canzona, you're going to be responsible for coordinating the first Fall Eater's work, and you'll report to me. And if I die, you're my second in command, and you'll take over. Now, I've made my dispositions according to custom, and if any man or woman seeks to disagree, they may do so freely.
After a moment, a woman stood up.
Lord Farr, ain't you a-taking any women on this expedition to look after them kids once you've found them?
No, Nell. We shall have little space as it is. Any kids we free will be better off in our care than where they've been.
But supposing you find out that you can't rescue them without some women in disguise as guards or nurses or whatever?
Well, I hadn't thought of that. We'll consider that most carefully when we retire into the parley room. You have my promise.
She sat down, and a man stood up.
Lord Farr, I heard you say that Lord Asriel is in captivity. Is it part of your plan to rescue him? Because if it is, and if he's in the power of them bears, as I think you said, that's going to need more than 170 men. And good friend as Lord Asriel is to us, I don't know as there's any call on us to go as far as that.
Adrian Brax, you're not wrong. What I had in my mind to do was to keep our eyes and ears open and see what knowledge we can glean while we're in the north. It may be that we can do something to help him, and it may not, but you can trust me not to use what you provided, Madam Gold, for any purpose outside the stated one of finding our children and bringing them home.
Another woman stood up.
Lord Farr, we don't know what them gobblers might have been doing to our children. We all heard rumours and stories of fearful things. We hear about children with no heads, or about children cut in half and sewn together, or about things too awful to mention. I'm truly sorry to distress anyone, but we all heard this kind of thing, and I want to get it out in the open. Now, in case you find anything of that awful kind, Lord Farr, I hope you're going to take powerful revenge. I hope you ain't going to let thoughts of mercy and gentleness hold your hand back from striking and striking hard and delivering a mighty blow to the heart of that infernal wickedness. and I'm sure I speak for any mother as has lost a child to the gobblers."
There was a loud murmur of agreement as she sat down. Heads were nodding all over the Saal. John Farr waited for silence and said,
"Nothing would hold my hand, Margaret, save only judgment. If I stay my hand in the north, it will only be to strike the harder in the south. To strike a day too soon is as bad as striking 100 miles off. To be sure, there's a warm passion behind what you say. But if you give in to that passion, friends, you're a-doing what I've always warned you again. You're a-placing the satisfaction of your own feelings above the work you have to do. Our work here is first rescue, then punishment. It ain't gratification for upset feelings. Our feelings don't matter. If we rescue the kids but we can't punish the gobblers, we've done the main task. But if we aim to punish the gobblers first, and by doing so lose the chance of rescuing the kids, we've failed. But be assured of this, Margaret. When the time comes to punish, we shall strike such a blow as will make their hearts faint and fearful. We shall strike the strength out of them. We shall leave them ruined and wasted, broken and shattered, torn in 1,000 pieces, and scattered to the 4 winds. Don't you worry that John Farr's heart is too soft to strike a blow when the time comes. And the time will come. Under judgment, not under passion. Is there anyone else who wants to speak? Speak if you will."
But no one did, and presently John Farr reached for the closing bell and rang it hard and loud, swinging it high and shaking the peals out of it so that they filled the hall and rang the rafters. John Farr and the other men left the platform for the parley room. Lyra was a little disappointed. Didn't they want her there too? But Tony laughed.
"They got plans to make. You done your part, Lyra. Now it's for John Farr and the council."
"But I ain't done nothing yet,"
Lyra protested as she followed the others reluctantly out of the hall and down the cobbled road toward the jetty.
"All I'd done was run away from Mrs. Coulter. That's just a beginning. I want to go north."
"Tell you what, I'll bring you back a walrus tooth. That's what I'll do."
Lyra scowled. For his part, Pantalaimon occupied himself by making monkey faces at Tony's demon, who closed her tawny eyes in disdain. Lyra drifted to the jetty and hung about with her new companions, dangling lanterns on strings over the black water to attract the goggle-eyed fishes who swam slowly up to be lunged at with sharp sticks and missed. But her mind was on John Farr and the parley room, and before long she slipped away up the cobbles again to the Saal. There was a light in the parley room window. It was too high to look through, but she could hear a low rumble of voices inside. So she walked up to the door and knocked on it firmly 5 times. The voices stopped, a chair scraped across the floor, and the door opened, spilling warm naphtha light out onto the damp step.
"Yes?"
said the man who'd opened it. Beyond him, Lyra could see the other men around the table, with bags of gold stacked neatly, and papers and pens, and glasses and a crock of Geneva.
"I want to come north,"
Lyra said, so they could all hear it.
"I want to come and help rescue the kids. That's what I set out to do when I run away from Mrs. Coulter, and before that even. I meant to rescue my friend Roger the kitchen boy from Jordan who was took. I want to come and help. I can do navigation, and I can take Anbarag magnetic readings off the Aurora, and I know what parts of a bear you can eat, and all kinds of useful things. You'd be sorry if you got up there and then found you needed me, and found you'd left me behind. And like that woman said, you might need women to play a part. Well, you might need kids too. You don't know. So you ought to take me, Lord Farr. Excuse me for interrupting your talk."
She was inside the room now, and all the men and their demons were watching her, some with amusement and some with irritation. But she had eyes only for John Farr. Pantalaimon sat up in her arms, his wildcat eyes blazing green. John Farr said,
"Lyra, there ain't no question of taking you into danger, so don't delude yourself, child. Stay here and help Mark Coster and keep safe. That's what you got to do."
"But I'm learning how to read the alethiometer too. It's coming clearer every day. You're bound to need that, bound to."
He shook his head.
"No. I know your hat was set on going north, but it's my belief not even Mrs. Coulter was going to take you. If you want to see the north, you'll have to wait till all this trouble's over. Now, off you go."
Pantalaimon hissed quietly, But John Farr's demon took off from the back of his chair and flew at them with black wings, not threateningly, but like a reminder of good manners. And Lyra turned on her heel as the crow glided over her head and wheeled back to John Farr. The door shut behind her with a decisive click.
"We will go,"
she said to Pantalaimon.
"Let him try to stop us. We will!"
Chapter 9. The Spies. Over the next few days, Lyra concocted a dozen plans and dismissed them impatiently, for they all boiled down to stowing away. And how could you stow away on a narrowboat? To be sure, the real voyage would involve a proper ship, and she knew enough stories to expect all kinds of hiding places on a full-sized vessel. The lifeboats, the hold, the bilges, whatever they were. But she'd have to get to the ship first, and leaving the fens meant travelling the Egyptian way. And even if she got to the coast on her own, she might stow away on the wrong ship. It would be a fine thing to hide in a lifeboat and wake up on the way to High Brazil. Meanwhile, all around her, the tantalizing work of assembling the expedition was going on day and night. She hung around Adam Stefanski, watching as he made his choice of the volunteers for the fighting force. She pestered Roger Van Poppel with suggestions about the stores they needed to take. Had he remembered snow goggles? Did he know the best place to get Arctic maps? The man she most wanted to help was Benjamin de Reuter, the spy. But he had slipped away in the early hours of the morning after the second roping, and naturally no one could say where he'd gone or when he'd return. So in default, Lyra attached herself to Father Coram.
"I think it'd be best if I help you, Father Coram, because I probably know more about the gobblers than anyone else, being as I was nearly one of them. Probably you'll need me to help you understand Mr. de Reuter's messages."
He took pity on the fierce, desperate little girl and didn't send her away. Instead, he talked to her and listened to her memories of Oxford and of Mrs. Coulter and watched as she read the Alethiometer.
"Where's that book with all the symbols in?"
she asked him one day.
"In Heidelberg."
"And is there just the one?"
"There may be others, but that's the one I've seen."
"I bet there's one in Bodley's library in Oxford."
She could hardly take her eyes off Father Coram's demon, who was the most beautiful demon she'd ever seen. When Pantalaimon was a cat, he was lean and ragged and harsh, but Sophonax, for that was her name, was golden-eyed and elegant beyond measure, fully twice as large as a real cat and richly furred. When the sunlight touched her, it lit up more shades of tawny, brown, leaf, hazel, corn, gold, autumn, mahogany than Lyra could name. She longed to touch that fur, to rub her cheeks against it, but of course she never did, for it was the grossest breach of etiquette imaginable to touch another person's demon. Demons might touch each other, of course, or fight, but the prohibition against human-demon contact went so deep that even in battle no warrior would touch an enemy's demon. It was utterly forbidden. Lyra couldn't remember having to be told that. She just knew it, as instinctively as she felt that nausea was bad and comfort good. So although she admired the fur of Sophonax and even speculated on what it might feel like, she never made the slightest move to touch her, and never would. Sophonax was as sleek and healthy and beautiful as Father Coram was ravaged and weak. He might have been ill, or he might have suffered a crippling blow, but the result was that he could not walk without leaning on two sticks, and he trembled constantly like an aspen leaf. His mind was sharp and clear and powerful, though, and soon Lyra came to love him for his knowledge and for the firm way he directed her.
"What's that hourglass mean, Father Coram?"
she asked over the Alethiometer one sunny morning in his boat.
"It keeps coming back to that."
"There's often a clue there if you look more close. What's that little old thing on top of it?"
She screwed up her eyes and peered.
"That's a skull."
"So? What do you think that might mean?"
"Death. Is that death?"
"That's right. So, in the hourglass range of meanings, you get death. In fact, after time, which is the first one, death is the second one."
"Do you know what I noticed, Father Coram? The needle stops there on the second go-round. On the first round, it kind of twitches, and on the second, it stops. Is that saying it's the second meaning, then?"
"Probably. Why are you asking it, Lyra?"
"I'm a-thinking."
She stopped, surprised to find that she'd actually been asking a question without realizing it.
"I just put three pictures together because I was thinking about Mr. de Reuter, see? And I put together the serpent and the crucible and the beehive to ask how he's a-getting on with his spying, and..."
"Why them three symbols?"
Because I thought the serpent was cunning, like a spy ought to be, and the crucible could mean knowledge, what you kind of distill. And the beehive was hard work, like bees are always working hard. So out of the hard work and the cunning comes the knowledge, see? And that's the spy's job. And I pointed to them, and I thought the question in my mind, and the needle stopped at death. Do you think that could be really working, Father Coram?
It's working all right, Lyra. What we don't know is whether we're reading it right. That's a subtle art. I wonder if...
Before he could finish his sentence, there was an urgent knock at the door, and a young Egyptian man came in.
Beg pardon, Father Coram. There's Jacob Huisman's just come back, and he's sore wounded.
He was with Benjamin de Ruyter. What's happened?
He won't speak. You better come, Father Coram, because he won't last long. He's a bleeding inside.
Father Coram and Lyra exchanged a look of alarm and wonderment, but only for a second, and then Father Coram was hobbling out on his sticks as fast as he could manage, with his demon padding ahead of him. Lyra came too, hopping with impatience. The young man led them to a boat tied up at the sugar beet jetty, where a woman in a red flannel apron held open the door for them. Seeing her suspicious glance at Lyra, Father Coram said,
"It's important the girl hears what Jacob's got to say, mistress."
So the woman let them in and stood back, with her squirrel demon perched silent on the wooden clock. On a bunk under a patchwork coverlet lay a man whose white face was damp with sweat and whose eyes were glazed.
"I sent for the physician, Father Coram,"
said the woman shakily.
"Please don't agitate him. He's in an agony of pain. He come in off Peter Hawker's boat just a few minutes ago."
"Where's Peter now?"
"He's a-tying up. It was him said I had to send for you."
"Quite right. Now, Jacob, can you hear me?"
Jacob's eyes rolled to look at Father Coram sitting on the opposite bunk, a foot or two away.
Hello, Father Coram."
Lyra looked at his demon. She was a ferret, and she lay very still beside his head, curled up but not asleep, for her eyes were open and glazed like his.
"What happened?"
"Benjamin's dead. He's dead, and Gerard's captured."
His voice was hoarse and his breath was shallow. When he stopped speaking, his demon uncurled painfully and licked his cheek, and taking strength from that, he went on.
"We was breaking into the Ministry of Theology because Benjamin had heard from one of the gobblers we caught that the headquarters was there. That's where all the orders was coming from."
He stopped again.
"You captured some gobblers?"
Jacob nodded and cast his eyes at his demon. It was unusual for demons to speak to humans other than their own, but it happened sometimes, and she spoke now.
"We caught three gobblers in Clerkenwell and made them tell us who they were working for and where the orders came from and so on. They didn't know where the kids were being taken, except it was north to Lapland."
She had to stop and pant briefly, her little chest fluttering before she could go on.
"And so them gobblers told us about the Ministry of Theology and Lord Boreal. Benjamin said him and Gerard Hook should break into the ministry and Franz Bruckman and Tom Mendham should go and find out about Lord Boreal."
"Did they do that?"
"We don't know. They never came back. Father Coram, it were like everything we did, they knew about before we did it. And for all we know, Franz and Tom were swallowed alive as soon as they got near Lord Boreal."
"Come back to Benjamin,"
said Father Coram, hearing Jacob's breathing getting harsher and seeing his eyes close in pain. Jacob's demon gave a little mew of anxiety and love, and the woman took a step or two closer, her hands to her mouth. But she didn't speak, and the demon went on faintly.
"Benjamin and Gerard and us went to the ministry at Whitehall and found a little side door, it not being fiercely guarded, and we stayed on watch outside while they unfastened the lock and went in. They hadn't been in but a minute when we heard a cry of fear, and Benjamin's demon came a-flying out and beckoned to us for help and flew in again. And we took our knife and ran in after her. Only the place was dark and full of wild forms and sounds that were confusing in their frightful movements. And we cast about, but there was a commotion above and a fearful cry. And Benjamin and his demon fell from a high staircase above us, his demon a-tugging and a-fluttering to hold him up, but all in vain, for they crashed on the stone floor and both perished in a moment. And we couldn't see anything of Gerard. But there was a howl from above in his voice, and we were too terrified and stunned to move. And then an arrow shot down at our shoulder and pierced deep down within."
The demon's voice was fainter, and a groan came from the wounded man. Father Coram leaned forward and gently pulled back the counterpane, and there, protruding from Jacob's shoulder, was the feathered end of an arrow in a mass of clotted blood. The shaft and the head were so deep in the poor man's chest that only 6 inches or so remained above the skin. Lyra felt faint. There was the sound of feet and voices outside on the jetty. Vardicorum sat up and said,
"Here's the physician, Jacob. We'll leave you now. We'll have a longer talk when you're feeling better."
He clasped the woman's shoulder on the way out. Lyra stuck close to him on the jetty because there was a crowd gathering already, whispering and pointing. Vardicorum gave orders for Peter Hawker to go at once to John Farr, and then said,
"Lyra, as soon as we know whether Jacob's going to live or die, we must have another talk about that alethiometer. You go and occupy yourself elsewhere, child. We'll send for you."
Lyra wandered away on her own and went to the reedy bank to sit and throw mud into the water. She knew one thing. She was not pleased or proud to be able to read the alethiometer. She was afraid. Whatever power was making that needle swing and stop, it knew things like an intelligent being.
"I reckon it's a spirit,"
Lyra said, and for a moment she was tempted to throw the little thing into the middle of the fen.
"I'd see a spirit if there was one in there,"
said Pantalaimon.
"Like that old ghost in Godstow. I saw that when you didn't."
"There's more than one kind of spirit. You can't see all of them. Anyway, what about those old dead scholars without their heads? I saw them, remember?"
"That was only a night ghast."
"It was not. They were proper spirits, all right, and you know it. But whatever spirit's moving this blooming needle ain't that sort of spirit."
"It might not be a spirit."
"Well, what else could it be?"
"It might be... it might be elementary particles,"
she scoffed.
"It could be. You remember that photo mill they got at Gabriel? Well then..."
At Gabriel College, there was a very holy object kept on the high altar of the oratory, covered, now Lyra thought about it, with a black velvet cloth like the one around the alethiometer. She had seen it when she accompanied the librarian of Jordan to a service there. At the height of the invocation, the intercessor lifted the cloth to reveal in the dimness a glass dome, inside which there was something too distant to see, until he pulled a string attached to a shutter above, letting a ray of sunlight through to strike the dome exactly. Then it became clear. A little thing like a weather vane, with 4 sails, black on one side and white on the other, that began to whirl around as the light struck it. It illustrated a moral lesson, the intercessor explained, and went on to explain what that was. 5 minutes later, Lyra had forgotten the moral, but she hadn't forgotten the little whirling vanes in the ray of dusty light. They were delightful, whatever they meant, and all done by the power of photons, said the librarian as they walked home to Jordan. So perhaps Pantalaimon was right. If elementary particles could push a photomill around, no doubt they could make light work of a needle. But it still troubled her.
"Lyra! Lyra!"
It was Tony Costa waving to her from the jetty.
"Come over here! You gotta go and see John Farr at the Zal! Run, gal, it's urgent!"
She found John Farr with Vardicorum and the other leaders, looking troubled. John Farr spoke.
"Lyra, child, Vardicorum has told me about your reading of that instrument. And I'm sorry to say that poor Jacob has just died. I think we're going to have to take you with us after all, against my inclinations. I'm troubled in my mind about it, but there don't seem to be any alternative. As soon as Jacob's buried, according to custom, we'll take our way. You understand me, Lyra, you're a-coming too, but it ain't an occasion for joy or jubilation. There's trouble and danger ahead for all of us. I will put in you under Father Coram's wing. Don't you be a trouble or a hazard to him, or you'll be a-feeling the force of my wrath. Now, cut along and explain to Mark Costa, and hold yourself in readiness to leave."
The next 2 weeks passed more busily than any time of Lyra's life so far. Busily, but not quickly, for there were tedious stretches of waiting, of hiding in damp, crabbed closets, of watching a dismal, rain-soaked autumn landscape roll past the window, of hiding again, of sleeping near the gas fumes of the engine and waking with a sick headache, and worst of all, of never once being allowed out into the air to run along the bank or clamber over the deck or haul at the lock gates or catch a mooring rope thrown from the lock side. Because, of course, she had to remain hidden. Tony Costa told her of the gossip in the waterside pubs, that there was a hunt the length of the kingdom for a little fair-haired girl, with a big reward for her discovery and severe punishment for anyone concealing her. There were strange rumours, too, People said she was the only child to have escaped from the gobblers, and she had terrible secrets in her possession. Another rumour said she wasn't a human child at all, but a pair of spirits in the form of child and demon, sent to this world by the infernal powers in order to work great ruin. And yet another rumour said it was no child but a fully grown human, shrunk by magic and in the pay of the Tartars, come to spy on good English people and prepare the way for a Tartar invasion. Lyra heard these tales at first with glee and later with despondency. All those people hating and fearing her, and she longed to be out of this narrow boxy cabin. She longed to be north already in the wide snows under the blazing aurora. And sometimes she longed to be back at Jordan College, scrambling over the roofs with Roger, with the steward's bell tolling half an hour to dinner time and the clatter and sizzle and shouting of the kitchen. Then she wished passionately that nothing had changed, nothing would ever change, that she could be Lyra of Jordan College forever and ever. The one thing that drew her out of her boredom and irritation was the alethiometer. She read it every day, sometimes with Father Coram and sometimes on her own, and she found that she could sink more and more readily into the calm state in which the symbol meanings clarified themselves, and those great mountain ranges touched by sunlight emerged into vision. She struggled to explain to Father Coram what it felt like.
It's almost like talking to someone, only you can't quite hear them, and you feel kind of stupid because they're cleverer than you, only they don't get cross or anything. And they know such a lot, Father Coram, as if they knew everything, almost. Mrs. Coulter was clever, she knew ever such a lot. But this is a different kind of knowing. It's like understanding, I suppose.
He would ask specific questions and she would search for answers.
What's Mrs. Coulter doing now?
He'd say, and her hands would move at once and he'd say,
tell me what you're doing.
Well, the Madonna is Mrs. Coulter, and I think my mother, when I put the hand there, and the aunt is busy, that's easy, that's the top meaning, and the hourglass has got time in its meanings, and partway down there's now, and I just fixed my mind on it.
And how do you know where these meanings are?
I kind of see them, or feel them, rather, like climbing down a ladder at night, you put your foot down and there's another rung. Well, I put my mind down and there's another meaning, and I kind of sense what it is. Then I put them all together. There's a trick in it, like focusing your eyes.
Do that, then, and see what it says.
Lyra did. The long needle began to swing at once, and stopped, moved on, stopped again in a precise series of sweeps and pauses. It was a sensation of such grace and power that Lyra, sharing it, felt like a young bird learning to fly. Father Coram, watching from across the table, noted the places where the needle stopped, and watched the little girl holding her hair back from her face and biting her lower lip just a little, her eyes following the needle at first, but then, when its path was settled, looking elsewhere on the dial. Not randomly, though. Father Coram was a chess player, and he knew how chess players looked at a game in play. An expert player seemed to see lines of force and influence on the board, and looked along the important lines and ignored the weak ones. And Lyra's eyes moved the same way, according to some similar magnetic field that she could see, and he couldn't. The needle stopped at the thunderbolt, the infant, the serpent, the elephant, and at a creature Lyra couldn't find a name for, a sort of lizard with big eyes and a tail curled around the twig it stood on. It repeated the sequence time after time, while Lyra watched.
What's that lizard mean?
Said Father Coram, breaking into her concentration.
It don't make sense. I can see what it says, but I must be misreading it. The thunderbolt, I think, is anger. And the child, I think it's me. I was getting the meaning for that lizard thing, but you talked to me, Father Coram, and I lost it. See, it's just floating any old where.
Yes, I see that. I'm sorry, Lyra. You tired now? Do you want to stop?
No, I don't,
she said, but her cheeks were flushed and her eyes bright. She had all the signs of fretful overexcitement, and it was made worse by her long confinement in this stuffy cabin. He looked out of the window. It was nearly dark, and they were travelling along the last stretch of inland water before reaching the coast. Wide brown, scummed expanses of an estuary extended under a dreary sky to a distant group of coal spirit tanks, rusty and cobwebbed with pipework, beside a refinery where a thick smear of smoke ascended reluctantly to join the clouds.
Where are we? Can I go outside just for a bit, Father Coram?
This is Colby Water.
the estuary of the River Cole. When we reach the town, we'll tie up by the smoke market and go on foot to the docks. We'll be there in an hour or two.
But it was getting dark, and in the wide desolation of the creek, nothing was moving but their own boat and a distant coal barge labouring toward the refinery. And Lyra was so flushed and tired, and she'd been inside for so long. And so Father Coram went on.
Well, I don't suppose it'll matter just for a few minutes in the open air. I wouldn't call it fresh, tent fresh, except when it's blowing off the sea. But you can sit out on top and look around till we get closer in.
Lyra leapt up, and Pantalaimon became a seagull at once, eager to stretch his wings in the open. It was cold outside, and although she was well wrapped up, Lyra was soon shivering. Pantalaimon, on the other hand, leapt into the air with a loud caw of delight, and wheeled and skimmed and darted now ahead of the boat, now behind the stern. Lyra exulted in it, feeling with him as he flew, and urging him mentally to provoke the old Tillerman's cormorant demon into a race. But she ignored him and settled down sleepily on the handle of the tiller, near her man. There was no life out on this bitter brown expanse, and only the steady chug of the engine and the subdued splashing of the water under the bows broke the wide silence. Heavy clouds hung low without offering rain. The air beneath was grimy with smoke. Only Pantalaimon's flashing elegance had anything in it of life and joy. As he soared up out of a dive with wide wings white against the grey, something black hurtled at him and struck. He fell sideways in a flutter of shock and pain, and Lyra cried out, feeling it sharply. Another little black thing joined the first. They moved not like birds, but like flying beetles, heavy and direct, and with a droning sound. As Pantalaimon fell, trying to twist away and make for the boat and Lyra's desperate arms, the black things kept driving into him, droning, buzzing and murderous. Lyra was nearly mad with Pantalaimon's fear and her own, but then something swept past her and upwards. It was the Tillerman's demon, and clumsy and heavy as she looked, her flight was powerful and swift. Her head snapped this way and that. There was a flutter of black wings, a shiver of white, and a little black thing fell to the tarred roof of the cabin at Lyra's feet just as Pantalaimon landed on her outstretched hand. Before she could comfort him, he changed into his wildcat shape and sprang down on the creature, batting it back from the edge of the roof where it was crawling swiftly to escape. Pantalaimon held it firmly down with a needle-filled paw and looked up at the darkening sky, where the black wing flaps of the cormorant were circling higher as she cast around for the other. Then the cormorant glided swiftly back and croaked something to the tiller man, who said,
"It's gone! Don't let that other one escape! Here!"
And he flung the dregs out of the tin mug he'd been drinking from and tossed it to Lyra. She clapped it over the creature at once. It buzzed and snarled like a little machine.
"Hold it still,"
said Father Coram from behind her, and then he was kneeling to slip a piece of card under the mug.
"What is it, Father Coram?"
"Let's go below and have a look. Take it careful, Lyra. Hold that tight."
She looked at the Tillerman's demon as she passed, intending to thank her, but her old eyes were closed. She thanked the tiller man instead.
"You ought to stay below,"
was all he said. She took the mug into the cabin where Father Coram had found a beer glass. He held the tin mug upside down over it and then slipped the card out from between them so that the creature fell into the glass. He held it up so they could see the angry little thing clearly. It was about as long as Lyra's thumb and dark green, not black. Its wing cases were erect, like a ladybird's about to fly, and the wings inside were beating so furiously that they were only a blur. Its six clawed legs were scrabbling on the smooth glass.
"What is it?"
Pantalaimon, a wildcat still, crouched on the table 6 inches away, his green eyes following it round and round inside the glass.
"If you was to crack it open, you'd find no living thing in there. No animal nor insect, at any rate. I seen one of these things afore, and I never thought I'd see one again this far north. Afric things. There's a clockwork running in there, and pinned to the spring of it, there's a bad spirit with a spell through its heart."
"But who sent it?"
"You don't even need to read the symbols, Lyra. You can guess as easy as I can."
"Mrs. Coulter?"
"Course. She ain't only explored up north. There's strange things aplenty in the southern wild. It was Morocco where I saw one of these last. Deadly dangerous while the spirit's in it. It won't never stop. And when you let the spirit free, it's so monstrous angry, it'll kill the first thing it gets at."
"But what was it after?"
"Spying. I was a cursed fool to let you up above. and I should have let you think your way through the symbols without interrupting.
I see it now. It means air, that lizard thing. I saw that, but I couldn't see why, so I tried to work it out, and I lost it.
Ah, then I see it too. And the lizard. That's why. It's a chameleon. And it stands for air, because they don't eat nor drink. They just live on air.
And the elephant?
Africa. Ah.
They looked at each other. With every revelation of the alethiometer's power, they became more awed by it.
It was telling us about these things all the time. We ought to have listened. But what can we do about this, Invader Corum? Can we kill it or something?
I don't know as we can do anything. We shall just have to keep him shut up tight in a box and never let him out. What worries me more is the other one has got away. He'll be a-flying back to Mrs. Coulter now with the news that he's seen you. Damn me, Lyra, but I'm a fool.
He rattled about in a cupboard and found a smoke leaf tin about 3 inches in diameter. It had been used for holding screws, but he tipped those out and wiped the inside with a rag before inverting the glass over it with the card still in place over the mouth. After a tricky moment when one of the creature's legs escaped and thrust the tin away with surprising strength, they had it captured and the lid screwed down tight.
As soon as we get about the ship, I'll run some solder around the edge to make sure of it.
But don't clockwork run down?
Ordinary clockwork, yes. But like I said, this one's kept tight wound by the spirit pinned to the end. The more he struggles, the tighter it's wound and the stronger the force is. Now, let's put this fella out the way.
He wrapped the tin in a flannel cloth to stifle the incessant buzzing and droning and stowed it away under his bunk. It was dark now, and Lyra watched through the window as the lights of Colby came closer. The heavy air was thickening into mist, and by the time they tied up at the wharves alongside the smoke market, everything in sight was softened and blurred. The darkness shaded into pearly silver-grey veils laid over the warehouses and the cranes, the wooden market stalls and the granite, many-chimneyed building the market was named after, where day and night fish hung kippering in the fragrant oak wood smoke. The chimneys were contributing their thickness to the clammy air, and the pleasant reek of smoked herring and mackerel and haddock seemed to breathe out of the very cobbles. Lyra, wrapped up in oilskin and with a large hood hiding her revealing hair, walked along between Father Coram and the tiller man. All three demons were alert, scouting around corners ahead, watching behind, listening for the slightest footfall. But they were the only figures to be seen. The citizens of Colby were all indoors, probably sipping Geneva beside roaring stoves. They saw no one until they reached the dock, and the first man they saw there was Tony Costa, guarding the gates.
Oh, thank God you got here,
he said quietly, letting them through.
We just heard as Jack Verhoeven's been shot and his boat sunk, and no one had heard where you was. John Farr's on board already and jumping to go.
The vessel looked immense to Lyra. A wheelhouse and funnel amidships, a high forecastle and a stout derrick over a canvas-covered hatch, yellow light agleam in the portholes and the bridge, and white light at the masthead, and 3 or 4 men on deck working urgently at things she couldn't see. She hurried up the wooden gangway ahead of Far Decorum and looked around with excitement. Pantalaimon became a monkey and clambered up the derrick at once, but she called him down again. Far Decorum wanted them indoors, or below, as you called it, on board ship. Down some stairs, or a companionway, there was a small saloon where John Farr was talking quietly with Nicholas Rokeby, the Egyptian in charge of the vessel. John Farr did nothing hastily. Lyra was waiting for him to greet her, but he finished his remarks about the tide and pilotage before turning to the incomers.
Good evening, friends. Poor Jack Verhoeven's dead, perhaps you've heard, and his boys captured.
We have bad news, too,
said Vardacorum, and told of their encounter with the flying spirits. John Farr shook his great head, but didn't reproach them.
Where is the creature now?
Father Coram took out the leaf tin and laid it on the table. Such a furious buzzing came from it that the tin itself moved slowly over the wood.
I've heard of them clockwork devils, but never seen one. There ain't no way of taming it and turning it back, I do know that much. Nor is it any use weighing it down with lead and dropping it in the ocean. Because one day it'd rush through and out the devil would come and make for the child whatever she was. No, we'll have to keep it by and exercise our vigilance.
Lyra being the only female on board, for John Farr had decided against taking women after much thought, she had a cabin to herself. Not a grand cabin, to be sure. In fact, little more than a closet with a bunk and a scuttle, which was the proper name for porthole. She stowed her few things in the drawer below the bunk and ran up excitedly to lean over the rail and watch England vanish behind, only to find that most of England had vanished in the mist before she got there. But the rush of water below, the movement in the air, the ship's lights glowing bravely in the dark, the rumble of the engine, the smells of salt and fish and coal spirit were exciting enough by themselves. It wasn't long before another sensation joined them as the vessel began to roll in the German Ocean swell. When someone called Lyra down for a bite of supper, she found she was less hungry than she'd thought, and presently she decided it would be a good idea to lie down, for Pantalaimon's sake, because the poor creature was feeling sadly ill at ease. And so began her journey to the north. His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman. Book 1, The Golden Compass. Part 2, Bolvanger. Chapter 10, The Consul and the Bear. John Farr and the other leaders had decided that they would make for Trollesund, the main port of Lapland. The witches had a consulate in the town, and John Farr knew that without their help, or at least their friendly neutrality, it would be impossible to rescue the captive children. He explained his idea to Lyra and Father Corum the next day, when Lyra's seasickness had abated slightly. The sun was shining brightly and the green waves were dashing against the bows, bearing white streams of foam as they curved away. Out on the deck, with the breeze blowing and the whole sea a-sparkle with light and movement, she felt little sickness at all. And now that Pantalaimon had discovered the delights of being a seagull and then a stormy petrel and skimming the wave-tops, Lyra was too absorbed by his glee to wallow in landlubberly misery. John Farr, Father Corum, and two or three others sat in the stern of the ship, with the sun full on them, talking about what to do next.
"Now Father Corum knows these Lapland witches,"
John Farr said,
"and if I ain't mistaken, there's an obligation there."
"That's right, John,"
said Father Corum.
"It were 40 years back, but that's nothing to a witch. Some of them live to many times that."
"What happened to bring this obligation about, Father Corum?"
said Adam Stefanski, the man in charge of the fighting troop.
"I saved the witch's life. She fell out of the air, being pursued by a great red bird like to nothing I'd seen before. She fell injured in the marsh, and I set out to find her. She was like to drowning, and I got her on board and shot that bird down, and it fell into a bog, to my regret, for it was as big as a bittern. And flame red."
The other men murmured, captured by Father Corum's story.
"Now when I got her in the boat, I had the most grim shock I'd ever known, because that young woman had no demon."
It was as if he'd said she had no head. The very thought was repugnant. The men shuddered, their demons bristled or shook themselves or cawed harshly, and the men soothed them. Pantalaimon crept into Lyra's arms, their hearts beating together.
"At least that's what it seemed. Being as she'd fell out of the air, I more than suspected she was a witch. She looked exactly like a young woman, thinner than some and prettier than most, but not seeing that demon gave me a hideous turn."
"Ain't they got demons then, the witches?"
said the other man, Michael Canzona.
"Their demons is invisible, I expect,"
said Adam Stefanski.
"He was there all the time. And Father Corum never saw him."
"No, you're wrong, Adam. He weren't there at all. The witches have the power to separate themselves from their demons a mighty sight further than what we can. If need be, they can send their demons far abroad on the wind or the clouds or down below the ocean. And this witch I found, she hadn't been resting above a hour when her demon came a-flying back, because he'd felt her fear and her injury, of course. And it's my belief, though she never admitted to this, but the great red bird I shot was another witch's demon in pursuit. Lord, that made me shiver when I thought of that. I'd have stayed my hand. I'd have taken any measures on sea or land. But there it was. Anyway, there was no doubt I'd saved her life. And she gave me a token of it, and said I was to call on her help if ever it was needed. And once she sent me help, when the Skraelin shot me with a poison arrow. We had other connections, too. I haven't seen her from that day to this, but she'll remember.
And does she live in Tralazon, this witch?
No, no, they live in forests and on the tundra, not in the seaport among men and women. Their business is with the wild. But they keep a council there. And I shall get word to her. Make no doubt about that.
Lyra was keen to know more about the witches, but the men had turned their talk to the matter of fuel and stores, and presently she grew impatient to see the rest of the ship. She wandered along the deck towards the bows, and soon made the acquaintance of an able seaman by flicking at him the pips she'd saved from the apple she'd eaten at breakfast. He was a stout and placid man, and when he'd sworn at her and been sworn at in return, they became great friends. He was called Jerry. Under his guidance, she found out that having something to do prevented you from feeling seasick, and that even a job like scrubbing a deck could be satisfying if it was done in a seaman-like way. She was very taken with this notion, and later on she folded the blankets on her bunk in a seaman-like way, and put her possessions in the closet in a seaman-like way, and used stow instead of tidy for the process of doing so. After 2 days at sea, Lyra decided that this was the life for her. She had the run of the ship, from the engine room to the bridge, and she was soon on first-name terms with all the crew. Captain Rokeby let her signal to a Hollands frigate by pulling the handle of the steam whistle. The cook suffered her help in mixing plum duff, and only a stern word from John Farr prevented her from climbing the foremast to inspect the horizon from the crow's nest. All the time they were steaming north, and it grew colder daily. The ship's stores were searched for oilskins that could be cut down for her, and Jerry showed her how to sew, an art she learned willingly from him, though she had scorned it at Jordan and avoided instruction from Mrs. Lonsdale. Together they made a waterproof bag for the alethiometer that she could wear around her waist in case she fell in the sea, she said. With it safely in place, she clung to the rail in her oilskins and sou'wester as the stinging spray broke over the bows and surged along the deck. She still felt seasick occasionally, especially when the wind got up and the ship plunged heavily over the crests of the grey-green waves, and then it was Pantalaimon's job to distract her from it by skimming the waves as a stormy petrel, because she could feel his boundless glee in the dash of wind and water and forget her nausea. From time to time he even tried being a fish, and once joined a school of dolphins to their surprise and pleasure. Lyra stood shivering in the forecastle and laughed with delight as her beloved Pantalaimon, sleek and powerful, leapt from the water with half a dozen other swift grey shapes. He had to stay close to the ship, of course, for he could never go far from her. But she sensed his desire to speed as far and as fast as he could for pure exhilaration. She shared his pleasure, but for her it wasn't simple pleasure, for there was pain and fear in it too. Suppose he loved being a dolphin more than he loved being with her on land. What would she do then? Her friend the able seaman was nearby, and he paused as he adjusted the canvas cover of the forward hatch to look out at the little girl's demon skimming and leaping with the dolphins. His own demon, a seagull, had her head tucked under her wing on the capstan. He knew what Lyra was feeling.
I remember when I first went to sea. My belly's sorry I hadn't settled on one form, I was that young. And she loved being a porpoise. I was afraid she'd settle like that. There was one old sailorman on my first vessel who could never go ashore at all because his demon had settled as a dolphin and he could never leave the water. Oh, he was a wonderful sailor. Best navigator you ever knew. Could have made a fortune at the fishing, but he wasn't happy at it. He was never quite happy till he died and he could be buried at sea.
Why do demons have to settle? I want Pantalaimon to be able to change forever. So does he.
Oh, they always have settled and they always will. That's part of growing up. There'll come a time when you'll be tired of his changing about and you'll want a settled kind of form for him.
I never will.
Oh, you will. You'll want to grow up like all the other girls. Anyway, there's compensations for a settled form.
What are they?
Knowing what kind of person you are. But take old Belisaria. She's a seagull, and that means I'm a kind of seagull too. I'm not grand and splendid, nor beautiful. But I'm a tough old thing, and I can survive anywhere and always find a bit of food and company. Ah, that's worth knowing, that is. And when your demon settles, you'll know the sort of person you are.
But suppose your demon settles in a shape you don't like?
Well, then, you're discontented, aren't you? There's plenty of folk who'd like to have a lion as a demon, and they end up with a poodle. Until they learn to be satisfied with what they are, they're going to be fretful about it. Waste of feeling, that is.
But it didn't seem to Lyra that she would ever grow up. One morning there was a different smell in the air, and the ship was moving oddly with a brisker rocking from side to side instead of the plunging and soaring. Lyra was on deck a minute after she woke up, gazing greedily at the land. Such a strange sight after all that water, for though they had only been at sea a few days, Lyra felt as if they had been on the ocean for months. Directly ahead of the ship, a mountain rose, green-flanked and snow-capped, and a little town and harbour lay below it. Wooden houses with steep roofs, an oratory spire, cranes in the harbour, and clouds of gulls wheeling and crying. The smell was of fish, but mixed with it came land smells too, pine resin and earth and something animal and musky, and something else that was cold and blank and wild. It might have been snow. It was the smell of the north. Seals frisked around the ship, showing their clown faces above the water before sinking back without a splash. The wind that lifted spray off the white-capped waves was monstrously cold and searched out every gap in Lyra's wolfskin, and her hands were soon aching and her face numb. Pantalaimon, in his ermine shape, warmed her neck for her, but it was too cold to stay outside for long without work to do, even to watch the seals, and Lyra went below to eat her breakfast porridge and look through the porthole in the saloon. Inside the harbour the water was calm, and as they moved past the massive breakwater, Lyra began to feel unsteady from the lack of motion. She and Pantalaimon avidly watched as the ship inched ponderously towards the quayside. During the next hour the sound of the engine died away to a quiet background rumble. Voices shouted orders or queries, ropes were thrown, gangways lowered, hatches opened.
"Come on, Lyra,"
said Father Coram.
"Is everything packed?"
Lyra's possessions, such as they were, had been packed ever since she'd woken up and seen the land. All she had to do was run to the cabin and pick up the shopping bag, and she was ready. The first thing she and Father Coram did ashore was to visit the house of the witch consul. It didn't take long to find it. The little town was clustered around the harbour, with the oratory and the governor's house the only buildings of any size. The witch consul lived in a green-painted wooden house within sight of the sea, and when they rang the bell it jangled loudly in the quiet street. A servant showed them into a little parlour and brought them coffee. Presently the consul himself came in to greet them. He was a fat man with a florid face and a sober black suit, whose name was Martin Lancelius. His demon was a little serpent, the same intense and brilliant green as his eyes, which were the only witch-like thing about him, though Lyra was not sure what she had been expecting a witch to look like.
"How can I help you, Father Coram?"
"In two ways, Dr. Lancelius. First, I'm anxious to get in touch with a witch lady I met some years ago in the fen country of Eastern Anglia. Her name is Seraphina Pecola."
Dr. Lancelius made a note with a silver pencil.
"How long ago was your meeting with her?"
"Must be 40 years. But I think she would remember."
"And what is the second way in which you seek my help?"
"I'm representing a number of Egyptian families who've lost children. We've got reason to believe there's an organization capturing these children, ours and others, and bringing them to the north for some unknown purpose. I'd like to know whether you or your people have heard of anything like this going on."
Dr. Lancelius sipped his coffee blandly.
"It's not impossible that notice of some such activity might have come our way. You realize the relations between my people and the Northlanders are perfectly cordial. It would be difficult for me to justify disturbing them."
Father Coram nodded as if he understood very well.
"To be sure. And it wouldn't be necessary for me to ask you if I could get the information any other way. That was why I asked about the witch lady first."
Now Dr. Lancelius nodded as if he understood. Lyra watched this game with puzzlement and respect. There were all kinds of things going on beneath it, and she saw that the witch consul was coming to a decision.
"Very well. Of course that's true, and you'll realize that your name is not unknown to us, Father Coram. Seraphina Pecola is queen of a witch clan in the region of Lake Enara. As for your other question, it is of course understood that this information is not reaching you through me."
"Quite so."
"Well, in this very town there is a branch of an organization called the Northern Progress Exploration Company, which pretends to be searching for minerals, but which is really controlled by something called the General Oblation Board of London. This organization, I happen to know, imports children. This is not generally known in the town. The Norway government is not officially aware of it. The children don't remain here long. They are taken some distance inland."
"Do you know where, Dr. Lancelius?"
"No, I would tell you if I did.
And do you know what happens to them there?
For the first time, Dr. Lancelius glanced at Lyra. She looked stolidly back. The little green serpent demon raised her head from the consul's collar and whispered tongue flickeringly in his ear. The consul said,
I have heard the phrase the Meierstadt process in connection with this matter. I think they use that in order to avoid calling what they do by its proper name. I have also heard the word intercision, but what it refers to I could not say.
And are there any children in the town at the moment?
He was stroking his demon's fur as she sat alert in his lap. Lyra noticed that she had stopped purring.
No, I think not. A group of about 12 arrived a week ago and moved out the day before yesterday.
Ah, as recent as that. Then that gives us a bit of hope. How did they travel, Dr. Lancelius?
By sledge.
And you have no idea where they went?
Very little. It's not a subject we're interested in.
Quite so. Now, you've answered all my questions very fairly, sir. And here's just one more. If you were me, what question would you ask of the Council of the Witches?
For the first time, Dr. Lancelius smiled.
I would ask where I could obtain the services of an armoured bear.
Lyra sat up and felt Pantalaimon's heart leap in her hands.
I understood the armoured bears to be in the service of the Oblation Board. I mean, the Northern Progress Company, or whatever they're calling themselves.
There is at least one who is not. You will find him at the sledge depot at the end of Langlokur Street. He earns a living there at the moment, but such is his temper and the fear he engenders in the dogs, his employment might not last for long.
Is he a renegade, then?
It seems so. His name is Jorek Birnison. You asked what I would ask, and I told you. Now here is what I would do. I would seize the chance to employ an armored bear, even if it were far more remote than this.
Lyra could hardly sit still. Father Coram, however, knew the etiquette for meetings such as this and took another spiced honey cake from the plate. While he ate it, Dr. Lancelius turned to Lyra.
I understand that you are in possession of an alethiometer,
he said to her great surprise, for how could he have known that?
Yes,
she said, and then, prompted by a nip from Pantalaimon, added,
would you like to look at it?
Oh, I should like that very much.
She fished inelegantly in the oilskin pouch and handed him the velvet package. He unfolded it and held it up with great care, gazing at the face like a scholar gazing at a rare manuscript.
How exquisite! I have seen one other example, but it was not so fine as this. And do you possess the books of readings?
No.
Lyra began, but before she could say any more, Father Coram was speaking.
No, the great pity is that although Lyra possesses the alethiometer itself, there's no means of reading it whatsoever. It's just as much of a mystery as the pools of ink the Hindus use for reading the future. And the nearest book of readings I know of is in the Abbey of St. Johann at Heidelberg.
Lyra could see why he was saying this. He didn't want Dr. Lancelius to know of Lyra's power. But she could also see something Father Coram couldn't, which was the agitation of Dr. Lancelius's demon, and she knew at once that it was no good to pretend. So she said,
actually, I can read it,
speaking half to Dr. Lancelius and half to Father Coram, and it was the consul who responded.
That is wise of you. Where did you obtain this one?
The master of Jordan College in Oxford gave it to me. Dr. Lancelius, do you know who made them?
They are said to originate in the city of Prague. The scholar who invented the first alethiometer was apparently trying to discover a way of measuring the influences of the planets according to the ideas of astrology. He intended to make a device that would respond to the idea of Mars or Venus as a compass responds to the idea of North. In that he failed, but the mechanism he invented was clearly responding to something, even if no one knew what it was.
And where did they get the symbols from?
Oh, this was in the 17th century. Symbols and emblems were everywhere. Buildings and pictures were designed to be read like books. Everything stood for something else. If you had the right dictionary, you could read nature itself. It was hardly surprising to find philosophers using the symbolism of their time to interpret knowledge that came from a mysterious source. But, you know, they haven't been used seriously for 2 centuries or so.
He handed the instrument back to Lyra and added,
may I ask a question? Without the books of symbols, how do you read it?
I just make my mind go clear And then it's sort of like looking down into water. You've got to let your eyes find the right level, because that's the only one that's in focus. Something like that.
I wonder if I might ask to see you do it?
Lyra looked at Father Coram, wanting to say yes, but waiting for his approval. The old man nodded.
What shall I ask?
What are the intentions of the Tatars with regard to Kamchatka?
That wasn't hard. Lyra turned the hands to the camel, which meant Asia, which meant Tatars, to the cornucopia for Kamchatka, where there were gold mines, and to the ant, which meant activity, which meant purpose and intention. Then she sat still, letting her mind hold the three levels of meaning together in focus, and relaxed for the answer, which came almost at once. The long needle trembled on the dolphin, the helmet, the baby, and the anchor, dancing between them and on to the crucible in a complicated pattern that Lyra's eyes followed without hesitation, but which was incomprehensible to the two men. When it had completed the movement several times, Lyra looked up. She blinked once or twice as if she were coming out of a trance.
They're going to pretend to attack it, but they're not really going to, because it's too far away, and they'd be too stretched out.
Would you tell me how you read that?
The dolphin. One of its deep-down meanings is playing, sort of like being playful. I know it's the 15th because it stopped 15 times, and it just got clear at that level but nowhere else. And the helmet means war, and both together they mean pretend to go to war, but not be serious. And the baby means, it means difficult. It'd be too hard for them to attack it. And the anchor says why. Because they'd be stretched out as tight as an anchor rope. I just see it all like that, you see.
Dr. Lansalius nodded.
Remarkable. I'm very grateful. I shall not forget that.
Then he looked strangely at Father Coram and back at Lyra.
Could I ask you for one more demonstration? If you look out of this window, you'll see a shed with 40 or more sprays of cloud pine hanging on the wall. One of them has been used by Serafina Pecola, and the others have not. Could you tell which is hers?
Yeah,
said Lyra, always ready to show off, and she took the alethiometer and hurried out. She was eager to see cloud pine because the witches used it for flying and she'd never seen any before. The two men stood by the window and watched as she kicked her way through the snow, Pantalaimon bouncing beside her as a hare, to stand in front of the wooden shed, head down, manipulating the alethiometer. After a few seconds, she reached forward and unhesitatingly picked out one of the many sprays of pine and held it up. Dr. Lansalius nodded. Lyra, intrigued and eager to fly, held it above her head and jumped and ran about in the snow, trying to be a witch. The consul turned to Father Coram and said,
Do you realize who this child is?
She's the daughter of Lord Asriel, and her mother is Mrs. Coulter of the Oblation Board.
And apart from that?
The old Egyptian had to shake his head.
No, I don't know any more. But she's a strange, innocent creature, and I wouldn't have her harmed for the world. How she comes to read that instrument, I couldn't guess. But I believe her when she talks of it. Why, Dr. Lansalius, what do you know about her?
The witches have talked about this child for centuries past. Because they live so close to the place where the veil between the worlds is thin, they hear immortal whispers from time to time in the voices of those beings who pass between the worlds. And they have spoken of a child such as this, who has a great destiny that can only be fulfilled elsewhere. Not in this world, but far beyond. Without this child we shall all die, so the witches say. But she must fulfill this destiny in ignorance of what she is doing. Because only in her ignorance can we be saved. Do you understand that, Father Coram?
No, I'm unable to say that I do.
What it means is that she must be free to make mistakes. We must hope that she does not, but we can't guide her. I'm glad to have seen this child before I die.
But how did you recognize her as being that particular child? And what did you mean about the beings who pass between the worlds? Well, I'm at a loss to understand you, Dr. Lansalius, for all that I judge you're an honest man.
But before the consul could answer, the door opened and Lyra came in, bearing a little branch of pine.
This is the one! I tested them all, and this is it, I'm sure. But it won't fly for me.
Well, Lyra, that is remarkable. You're lucky to have an instrument like that. I wish you well with it. I would like to give you something to take away with you.
He took the spray and broke off a twig for her.
Did she really fly with this?
Yes, she did. But then she is a witch, and you are not. I can't give you all of it because I need it to contact her, but this will be enough. Look after it.
Yes, I will. Thank you.
And she tucked it into her purse beside the alethiometer. Vardacorum touched the spray of pine as if for luck, and on his face was an expression Lyra had never seen before, almost a longing. The consul showed them to the door, where he shook hands with Vardacorum and shook Lyra's hand too.
I hope you find success,
he said, and stood on his doorstep in the piercing cold to watch them up the little street.
He knew the answer about the Tartars before I did,
Lyra told Vardacorum.
The alethiometer told me, but I never said. It was the crucible.
I expect he was testing you, child. But you done right to be polite, being as we can't be sure what he knows already. And that was a useful tip about the bear. I don't know how we would have heard otherwise.
They found their way to the depot, which was a couple of concrete warehouses in a scrubby area of waste ground, where thin weeds grew between grey rocks and pools of icy mud. A surly man in an office told them that they could find the bear off duty at 6, but they'd have to be quick, because he usually went straight to the yard behind Einarsson's bar, where they gave him drink. Then Vardacorum took Lyra to the best outfitters in town and bought her some proper cold-weather clothing. They bought a parka made of reindeer skin, because reindeer hair is hollow and insulates well. The hood was lined with wolverine fur, because that sheds the ice that forms when you breathe. They bought underclothing and boot liners of reindeer calfskin, and silk gloves to go inside big fur mittens. The boots and mittens were made of skin from the reindeer's forelegs, because that is extra tough, and the boots were soled with the skin of the bearded seal, which is as tough as walrus hide, but lighter. Finally, they bought a waterproof cape that enveloped her completely, made of semi-transparent seal intestine. With all that on, and a silk muffler around her neck and a woolen cap over her ears and the big hood pulled forward, she was uncomfortably warm. But they were going to much colder regions than this. John Farr had been supervising the unloading of the ship, and was keen to hear about the witch consul's words, and even keener to learn of the bear.
We'll go to him this very evening. Have you ever spoken of such a creature, Vardacorum?
Yes, I have, and fought one too, though not by myself, thank God. We must be ready to treat with him, John. He'll ask a lot, I've no doubt, and be surly and difficult to manage, but we must have him.
Oh, we must. And what of your witch?
Well, she's a long way off, and a clan queen now. I did hope it might be possible for a message to reach her, but it would take too long to wait for a reply.
Well, now let me tell you what I found, old friend.
For John Farr had been fidgeting with impatience to tell them something. He had met a prospector on the quayside, a new Dane from the country of Texas, and this man had a balloon of all things. The expedition he'd been hoping to join had failed for lack of funds even before it had left Amsterdam, so he was stranded.
Think what we might do with the help of an aeronaut, Vardacorum,
said John Farr, rubbing his great hands together.
I've engaged him to sign up with us. Seems to me we struck luckier coming here.
Luckier still if we had a clear idea of where we were going,
said Vardacorum. But nothing could damp John Farr's pleasure in being on campaign once more.